My name's James Beatty.
And I'm Sean Carroll.
And welcome to the Rebuild Health and Fitness podcast, where we help you build your health and fitness. All right, and welcome back to the Rebuild Health and Fitness podcast. This is season 2, episode 9, I believe. And today we have on Matt Hampton. How are you, Matt?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you guys?
Marvellous.
Good man.
So Matt is an extremely experienced PT from South Australia, Adelaide, am I right?
Correct.
Yeah. So, and I must say before we start, obviously if you're watching this as a visual, understand, like you are jacked, right? And, you know, you look like you've been carved out of, you know, stone, but not just any shitty stone, like some grade A granite type body. It's amazing. And what caught our eye with Matt was he had a goal at the end of this year to break the Australian bench press record at his body weight, which would have been around 250 kilos you were aiming for.
Yeah, well, actually, the record of my body weight I was aiming for was 242. I was going to aim for 242 and a half or 243. But the goal was to hit 250 first and then, you know, take it easy or clear it by a lot.
Yeah, which is incomprehensible to a lot of people. It's quite comprehensible for me because I can't even deadlift that amount of weight, so I sort of get it. But on top of this, he is an online coach. He's super passionate about health and fitness, and he is evidence-based in his approach to training and nutrition, which what excites us even more about this conversation today, because I think it's really good to connect with other people that are evidence-based in what they are talking about. As we know, there is a lot of shit,
a lot of rubbish
going around.
Agreed.
So Matt, take us back. Tell us a little bit about yourself, who you are, how you grew up, and how did you even get into this industry?
All right, I'll give you the quick rundown. I've always been a sporting or athletic type person. I played sports all my childhood. And I definitely started lifting early too, probably early for my time. This time, I think people lift a lot earlier, but I was lifting weights at about 15 years old, but I was playing all sorts of sports. I started playing volleyball as my primary sport, and that's mainly because the school I was in was a special interest volleyball school. And I took volleyball quite seriously, played it all through school. When school finished, I was about 6'1", 6'2", maybe 85 kilos, not really going anywhere with volleyball. I thought, oh, well, but the year after school, I grew 2 more inches, I grew 6'4", and then all of a sudden, the people at SASI, which is the South Australian Sports Institute, they're like, oh, you've gotten taller. Like, you want to come play volleyball? I was like, all right, I'll give it another crack. So I started playing volleyball for the state, and I got better. And part of the volleyball training was strength and conditioning at a higher level, you know, learning how to deadlift and clean and do these things correctly. And I think that really sparked my interest in terms of weightlifting. And after some knee tendinopathy issues with volleyball, I ended up growing the passion, the love for the weights and the rehab side of things. And then obviously started lifting more and wanting to get bigger and wanting to get stronger and falling in love with it all and wanting to help other people. And all of a sudden, before I knew it, I was completely in the fitness industry and out of the volleyball sporting industry. So that's sort of like a really, really quick rundown of how it sort of came from, you know, school, sporting, to transitioning into weightlifting and becoming obsessed with sort of getting stronger and bigger.
And how was your like initial introduction into the PT world? Were you one of them ones who just went into like an anytime fitness, or did you start off into like a boutique fitness gym? Because I know for us, when we started, I think everyone's first gym is always a bit of a challenge until you find that sort of good mentor to sort of show you the light kind of thing.
Oh yeah, I failed at the start for sure. Got my qualification and went into a YMCA gym. It was quite a big gym, but I just couldn't get my foot off the ground. I couldn't get started. I had some knowledge, but I mean, it was nothing really at the time. You know, you get your degree and you think you're smart, but then you realize you're not very smart. So I couldn't get many clients. And then I think my PT actually picked up when I moved to Melbourne. I started, you know, doing more research, finding more evidence-based practitioners, becoming more in line with that sort of community. And once I sort of started connecting with people, I found out a lot more, became a lot more educated, not only in and nutrition and fitness, but in business as well.
Yeah. So how old are you now, Matt?
I am almost 30.
Almost 30.
Almost 30.
Not bad. I'm 31.
29.
So yeah.
Oh yeah, snap.
And what age did you get into? What age did you get into fitness, like in terms of personal training?
I would have been about 20.
Yeah.
Okay.
Pretty standard. So obviously you spoke about your athletic background, obviously starting with volleyball, getting some sport-specific training, which I think is always a great thing, and then obviously fell in love with obviously lifting heavy to build the amount of mass that you have done. But obviously, would you say that you're a bodybuilder? What would you say that you do?
I think my initial, after volleyball, I definitely take a small shift in terms of training for performance. I started training for aesthetics.
Yeah.
And I'm a very, I like to take things to the extreme. Like, if I do something, I want to be the best at it. And I started initially going through like the bodybuilding path, but I realized that the bodybuilders are complete freaks.
Yeah.
And that I would never be mentally
or physically?
Both.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're just like we were talking before, they're built different, they're genetically different. I just didn't have the structure to be a good bodybuilder. So I think I just switched that back to training performance, keep trying to get better and stronger, help other people. And then I sort of realized I was getting quite strong.
Yeah.
Were you naturally strong? Like initially, you know how some people got that like farm boy strength kind of thing, or have you had to work really bloody hard to get where you are today?
I was definitely strong. But I wasn't crazy strong. It's funny, I actually started bench pressing at a very young age. I would have been about 15 or 16 or so when I started bench pressing a lot. I actually got a bench press and put it in my room, and I put it next to my bed. So I had my bed and my bench press, and that was pretty much it.
Yeah.
So I was benching like 100 kilos in school, and I was probably maybe 85 kilos at the time. So I was probably strong at my time. And before I actually went and started using PEDs, my bench was well over 150, probably 160 or so for reps. So it was always quite strong.
So we'll just touch on that now. Obviously, PEDs, performance enhancing drugs. I think, how old were you when you took them for the first time? If your bench
25,
was that much?
26. Yeah. 25, actually, I reckon.
And you're probably talking from the science and the literature. This is a pretty sharp age. If you've not just gone straight into lifting, straight on them. You've just said you started lifting at 15. You're now 25. Your bench is 160. You're probably doing some other astronomical lifts. And then they're like, right, where can we take this? Yeah. Where now, especially in the UK, like we're seeing them younger and younger. Like my first thing of them was around like that sort of 16 years old. A lot of people getting on them, not even close to being developed, just from an aesthetic point of view, because they want to look better so they can get on the piss on the weekend and look better in a shirt.
I think the realization was that none of my people I was aspiring to, or none of the goals I'd set were actually achievable naturally. I just didn't really have any idea. I thought the powerlifters and the bodybuilders, or maybe not the bodybuilders, but I thought everyone was natural, for the better part.
Yeah.
And then I guess that realization hit, and I realized that if I want to achieve these goals I'm setting, they're not possible, actually impossible, without going down this path. So that's sort of like, it's either do this or change my entire trajectory of goals.
And it's a really interesting thing, and I'm sort of glad this came up. Obviously, it wasn't even on the run sheet, because you are right in terms of what people see from this outlook. It might be social media, it might be whatever. Obviously, you've got, 17,500 followers yourself. So many people have this visual and they think like, fuck, I want to get this. I want to do this. But they are completely denied in... A lot of these people are on performance enhancing drugs. Do you know what I mean? And you're looking at strong. You're looking at strongmen. You're looking at bodybuilders. Their job is to get as strong as possible. Their job is not to do it naturally. They don't see, that's not a thing in their brain. They're like, how strong can I get? How big can I get with bodybuilding? Now you look at the Olympia stage from now to 20 years ago. Two very different visuals that you're getting there. So I just think it's an interesting point. Like you said, the people that you're inspiring to be. You couldn't do that naturally, and not many people can.
No, yeah, I think just the way that PEDs are looked at and are viewed is very it can vary a lot. It's very frowned upon in many areas, when many people don't realize the widespread use in certain goals and certain specific scenarios. So, I mean, I don't think they're good or bad. I think it's very context dependent.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think people often get the wrong idea or the wrong uses for these things.
Yeah, the danger's in the dose a lot of the time. They can be took extremely well, and they are just, I can't get this, so much more common than what people believe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you'd be shocked. I mean, most people would be shocked in terms of how common they are.
As much like
you don't need to look like you're taking drugs to be taking yeah. taking these drugs.
And it what most certainly doesn't take away. Nothing pisses me off more than it's like, yeah, well, I could do that if I took them. No, you fucking couldn't. No, you bloody could not. What are you talking about? I could be on stage if I try it. Trust me, you will not. Promise you that.
Yeah, it's like, do it then. It's all like the sumo deadlift argument. It's just like, someone's like, oh, if you say sumo, it doesn't count. It's like, oh, you do sumo then. You lift 300 kilos sumo. Like, you can't do it.
So if you don't mind, like, talk us through that initial journey from going natural to taking some PEDs and what that sort of felt like, and the improvements you saw in your training, and like, yeah, what was all that like for you for the first time?
Very exciting. Lots of weight gain and muscle gain. It's almost like you restarted your training again. It's almost like you become a beginner again, even though you're clearly not a beginner. You get to progress at that rate again. It's like, wow, this makes sense now. Like, this is why these people are so much bigger and stronger. They've almost got like a second progression method in them. They can use this whole, they've got training, nutrition, and then they've got PEDs. And that third thing is like another boost to everything. So it was very interesting and fulfilling process initially. Obviously, I'm not going to try to talk them up. There's obviously dangers involved and so much involved in it, but it was rewarding for sure.
Yeah, and I think then it's coming off it. What I've seen with people on the past, they come off it and then have they got that discipline to carry on training? Because it's inevitable there's going to be some mass loss when you come off. You have to make sure you're doing the right hormonally, what you're getting done. At this point, it's not as easy as just stopping then starting again. Do you know what I mean? There's a little bit that goes into it, which people don't think about.
So much goes into it. And I mean, in my mind, if you're going to go ahead and take these things, you're pretty much committing yourself for life, or for at least several years, because the goal, the reason you should be taking this thing should be quite a large goal.
Yeah.
And that goal should be years long. If you just want to look good or you want to do something short term, it's like, do you really need them? I mean, it's up to you, but probably not.
Yeah. Because you can build like a nice aesthetic body without them if you just care about aesthetics. And I think the other interesting thing is, I think it was Eric Helm, but our research paper a few years ago about rates of muscle mass gain, where, you know, he's talking him, what he would say is like an advanced trainer, that he would train every year, get his volume, get his progressions right, you know, his muscle protein synthesis, make sure he's eating enough. And even if he does everything perfect, he may grab 1 to 2 kilos of muscle mass per year.
Yeah.
Everything right.
Absolutely. I mean, my philosophy is, and I'm sure many other evidence-based people lies, you know, the first 1 to 2 years of training, that is the majority of your muscle gain. After those first 2 years, that's pretty much most of the gains you're going to get. Yeah. And sad as that sounds, you're going to keep gaining muscle after that, that's pretty much how you're going to look if you've done a good job.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, but if you are at a certain level of leanness, then post that, you know, that 1 gram, what that 1 to 2 kilograms can look a hell of a lot different on a human body.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing is, like, we change, like, physiques change. Like, one weight at this certain time in your life compared to another weight in a certain time of your life, it can look completely different. So it's very, very context dependent, goal dependent. You know, what are you training like? What are you training for, etc.
No, I love it. So tell us now, how tall are you and what do you weigh now? And what did you weigh before the injury that we'll talk about pretty soon?
I'm 6'4" and I'm currently about 118 kilos at the moment. And prior to the injury, I was 126, 127 kilos and obviously 6'4".
It's a big man.
I did drop probably 12, 13 kilos quite quickly after the injury. Just from not eating and being hospital and just not moving at all
for
a few weeks.
Yeah, for sure. So talk us about your goal. Obviously, we mentioned it at the beginning, your goal for this year. Talk us a bit about that. Why? Why that? Yeah. What was your thought process around it?
So at the end of last year, I never really thought about powerlifting all that much, but I've always trained bench press. I'm a very basic trainer. I like focusing on the fundamental movements, basic movement patterns, and getting stronger. And I sort of thought, oh, let's do my bench presses that. And it's end of the year last year, so I was still max. I got 220 up. And I was like, okay, 220 bench press. I was like, wonder what the record is for some of my weight. And I sort of going through the Australian statistics, and I was like, oh shit, 242 kilos. I'm like, all right, I can do that.
That's cool.
So then I went and saw Seb or Sebastian or
strength coach.
Yeah, I was strength coach, and I was like, well, maybe I'll be able to get like another 10, 20 kilos on the bench. without really even gaining much more size and just altering my technique, utilizing more powerlifting style, reducing range of motion, etc. So I thought, oh, well, I'll change my technique up, widen my grip, increase my arch, you know, let's build it back up and see where we're at. And obviously the goal was to try to beat the record and ultimately get a 250-kilo bench press, which I thought was well within my grasp considering where I was at without training for powerlifting. So I started light. I went and saw Seb. And after that week, I thought, let's bring a bench back to 140, work on technique. So first week of my technique, I was on 140. And then every week I increased by 140 for 10 reps.
Yeah.
And then every week I increased by about 10 kilos. And I got to about 180 for 10 reps. I'm like, all right, this is feeling pretty good. I mean, this is about 10 or 12 weeks into my training block. I hadn't actually taken a deload yet either. I was just, because it was a very slow progression. Anyway, I got sick that week and I thought, I took time off gym, still hit my bench chest. And I thought, I would have conservative testing, you know, see where I'm at. Because this is like, you know, still start of the year, still mid year, still a long way away from my goal. I thought maybe I'll get 230, 235, maybe more, considering my predicted one I ran was probably about 235, 240.
Yep.
And yeah, I was going into my bench session. And this is when obviously I tore it. And I felt a bit off. I was just tired and sick, probably load mismanagement slightly from many things. But you sort of get ahead of yourself and get excited and get arrogant at times when you're not kind of thinking about things too clearly. And I just never thought I'd chair pet. Never thought it. Never crossed my mind. Because I never really pick up a weight I can't lift. I'm always very confident under the bar. And I actually called it early that day. I thought, I'll do 220, call it there, rest up, and then, you know, do my testing the next week or week after. And I, I put 220 in the bar, and obviously it just ripped. My chest just ripped around the middle. And I was in agony. I was in pain, and I was shocked. I think I was more surprised it actually happened. I got injured. I wasn't used to getting injured. Mm. I'd normally train quite very conservative. I don't really train to failure. I'm very good with my load management. Just very unexpected. I guess the sad part is that it sort of threw off my entire look on my goals this year and my quest to become the Australian record holder in bench press. And you know, it will happen within you know, 6 months of deciding to get the record. The pec tear was actually quite a short time frame. So I never really got a chance to really get into it and even attempt it or even try a new max or anything, which is kind of disappointing. But
it sounds like you would have been extremely close. If not, you would have got it done. That was, you know, you were hitting them numbers that far out.
I was very quietly confident with what I was going to do. I was heavier than what I was going to be for the meet. That's the thing as well. I was about 125, 126, 127 sometimes. I was going to compete at 120.
Yeah, right.
But that wasn't it. I can drop weight very easily. I can stop training legs. I just wanted to hit the bench press.
Yeah.
So that was my only concern there. But yeah, it's I was on track, and unfortunately, stuff happens, and that's just the price I paid.
So just out of pure curiosity, when you were lifting and your pec went, like obviously you would have had a spotter. Did they? Were they good at what they were doing? Did they jump in right away, or did that bar like land on top of you?
This is interesting about the spotter, because didn't you say your missus spots you?
Yeah, she spots me. She's like, I don't know, 70 kilos at most. She's a, you know, a short, not very strong person. Oh, and she's very strong. She's I guess she's not going to lift 220
kilos strong though. Yeah.
Yeah. And like I'm the user, just so she can unrack me so I can maintain tightness in my positioning. I didn't actually. My philosophy is that you shouldn't need a spotter, to be honest. You shouldn't need a spotter when you're bench pressing, because you shouldn't be taking it to failure. You shouldn't be lifting a weight you can't lift. The spotter shouldn't have to lift the weight up for you. That's sort of my thing. So she just sits standing back, you know, she knows I can do the weight too. And obviously it tears and I yell out and she's freaked and went to grab the bar. She can't do anything. Mm. And I'm just instinctively trying to put the weight away from my torn side.
Yep.
Oh, sorry, get my torn side out of the way. And I sort of crushed my hand in the rack. The safeties were there, but the new technique in the arch, they were too low.
Yeah.
And then I had, because the gym I'm at only has rubber plates, so the plates go right to the end of the bar when you got 220 on there. And everyone sort of ran over, and they're trying to pick the bar, but there's no, like, there's no end of the bar to grab.
Yeah,
so they're trying
yeah.
to go, they're trying to grab under the plates, and I thought it took, you know, four or five people to actually get the bar out of me, and I'm just trying to slide out of there. It was, that process probably wasn't the best either. Yeah. My partner was actually quite scared that I might have hurt myself.
That's a hell of a lot, you know. There's a lot of weight to be on top of you if them safeties were a little bit low. That's why I don't bother getting that strong, you know. I just don't bother. It's just not worth the safety. I don't want to panic everybody around me, you know. That's why I just keep my bench relatively, you know.
Yeah. I think I personally wasn't that panicked, to be honest. Like, I personally wasn't that panicked because I can pause it there. I can keep the weight there. I think it's just the tear and the freak out and everyone was sort of freaking out. It made things a lot worse with the trying to get the weight off.
Well, I guess like with any injury when you're pursuing a goal, like the last thing you want to hear from physio, surgeon, whatever, is you'll no longer be able to do the thing you were trying to do. And that was, from what I saw on Instagram, something that happened next. Can you talk us through like what the initial conversations were like around the surgery and repair of your pec and what that was like mentally for you?
Yeah, that was probably the hardest conversation I've ever had in my whole life. And for some people might think, oh, really? Like a conversation about your pec, you know, not being attached again, the hardest conversation of your life? I'm like, yeah. That's how much it meant to me at the time. But because the tear was in my muscle belly, which is very uncommon, normally the tendon just snaps off and it's quite easy to repair. You just pin it back on the humerus. But my muscle belly tear, obviously, was right through the muscle belly.
It's so rare.
And extremely rare, and it's a very hard place to tear because this muscle belly is thick and strong. It shouldn't tear, really. Normally the smaller point is the tendon. I spoke to the surgeon very shortly after the MRI scans. And I mean, it's obviously his job to do the best he can and give me the best advice he can. He did tell me in a very calm, you know, nice way, but he pretty much said to me that, I've seen your MRI scan and I've got some unfortunate news. And he said, unfortunately, your chest is inoperable. We can't repair this type of injury. He says, you will lose your pec major on that side. It will eventually atrophy and shrivel up and you'll have a large deformity on that side and you lose all function of that muscle. And you can live on your life. You'll have reduced strength, but obviously there'll be the aesthetic appearance difference. And obviously the strength would be down, so your goals would no longer be achievable. And they sort of hung up. But I was like, I was asking, like, are you sure? He's like, yeah, you can't stitch the muscle back to the muscle. It just pulls apart. It's like two bits of steak. You know, you just can't stitch them together. They can't repair them. So that was the really sad news. And I was really upset. I was going to be this deformed guy with one pec and one just, I guess, gap with the awkward lump. And that night was just upsetting, really upsetting for me.
Fuck. Because, you know, there's so much emotion there. And people listening might be going, like you said, you know, it's only to repair, you're okay, you're safe. But when you've trained your whole life for something and putting so much time and effort to want to get this goal, to get this strength goal, want to look aesthetically pleasing, you know, that is important to some people. And then just get all that ripped away from you in.
Yeah, I think even just like it was really upsetting to not be able to hit the goal, but just because I've been bench pressing for 15 years, to lose my ability to actually lift some bench press and heavy weight was just really, really hit me hard.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things, the first thing that everyone does when they go to the gym, right? It's like the first exercise everyone makes good improvements on, it's bench. Like no matter how hungover you're feeling or how average on a Monday, you could always come in and bench. Like it's not as hard as squats. You'd always just bang it out and feel good.
Yeah. Like everyone's got to get that 100 kilo bench club. Like that's the first gym goal like in the world. Like that's the standard. Yeah,
that's it. What do you squat? Don't worry about it.
Yeah. Yes.
So obviously talk from there because I think you spoke to someone else after this.
Yeah, I actually spoke to a few people. And I mean, after this, I got some more bad news. I'm like, okay, this is not good. And I eventually spoke to this guy, in Adelaide, Dr. Chen too. And he says, look, I've opened up here before. And he says, the pec muscle, you know, transitions into the tendon. But he says, sometimes when I've opened people up, I've looked underneath their pec muscle and some of the tendon continues to travel under the muscle right up into about the middle of the chest. And he's like, where your tear is, you might have some of that tendon traveling underneath the muscle, still be able to pull across and attach. He's like, it hasn't really been done, but it's possible. Like, you probably won't get the same result with a regular repair, but at least you have your aesthetic back. You have your chest there. And he's like, the MRI doesn't show it. I know the MRI doesn't show it. He's like, I have to open you up and just take a risk. And at that stage, I was just like, I was very willing to do that because I wanted to keep my chest and I wanted to have at least an opportunity to get my chest back and maybe bench press again. And he opened me up and he found that some tendon did go underneath the muscle of the chest. And he managed to grab that and pin that on. I mean, it's not a full tendon. Like, it's not going to support my whole chest, but it's attached. And that's the main thing for now.
That must have been so pleasing to hear, to someone say, hey, let's give this a go. And you've just clearly gone, fuck yeah.
I think most people didn't want to open me up and give it a go because I guess, and surgeons have their reputation. They want to have successful surgeries. I mean, this is a very risky surgery because there's a low chance of a positive outcome. And I'm just so glad that because I went into surgery, put me to sleep, not knowing whether I was going to wake up with my chest attached or my chest not attached. And it was so nice to hear. He's like, we've attached it. I looked down, I was like, oh, it's attached. And like, it's very differently attached, but it's attached. And he showed me pictures of it. He's like, look, this is what we found. And it's like this pathetic little string of a she's like, I've got it on with this. I'm like, oh shit. I mean, good. Like, thank you so much. I'm like, what does this mean? And he's like, it's good. He's like, it's good. I'm like, okay.
Yeah. And the body's bloody breathtaking, isn't it? Like how adaptable it is. But tell us on from this as well. Cause I heard, like, did they find something with your heart as well? Was that why they were in the surgery? It's fucking bonkers. Like everything I kept looking up, researching last night, I was like, oh my God, it's going deeper. there's all sorts.
Yeah. So I finished the surgery and that was successful. I was like, great. Like, get me out of hospital. And then they're doing my ECGs and stuff. And they're like, oh, okay, this isn't right. And they're like, keep me in. So like, let's test you again in an hour. Let's test you again. And they're like, oh yeah. You got atrial fibrillation. So your heart isn't in sync. It's not beating properly. It's like, yeah, you have to stay. And they took my food away from me. It's like, no more eating. You're staying out at night. You've got surgery tomorrow. I'm like, oh my God. And I'm freaking out at stage because I'm like, heart surgery, like that's serious. Mm. I mean, and they sort of confirmed me that heart surgery, this one wasn't that serious, but in my mind it's like, freaking out. And I think that the big thing is like the next morning they got me in there and I've just got my pec reattached, so I can't move my arm, and I'm in pain, I'm on painkillers. And they're trying to get to my heart, they take my clothes off and they're like, putting monitors in my arm. It's like, we need this arm to move. We need this arm to be like here. I'm like, that arm's not going there. It's staying like in its sling. And like, no, it's not staying in its sling. I'm like, oh my God. I was like, if my chest snaps now to save my heart, this will be a big waste of time. But yeah, they eventually sort of got me in position and I was sort of like, I think they actually put me under before they moved me too much. Mm. I made sure I brought in someone else. I spoke to one of the other doctors privately. It's like, can you come in the room with them and ensure my pec stays attached? Yeah. And his job was just to take look at the pec. So he took care of the pec. They did the heart surgery. The heart surgery, I'm actually not even sure like what they were shoving down my throat and what they were doing, because the way they explained it to me is they just have to shock me back into defib me. Just defib me, shock me back into rhythm. That's all good. So I don't know why I was, have tubes in my throat and under, passed out and stuff. So, and that was successful too. My heart was back normal after that. So it was a bit of a side bend in the story. But.
Yeah, that's, I mean, what a crazy, and I did laugh when, did someone say to you, oh, well, do you want your pec or your heart? And you're like, oh, well.
I was like, yeah, I mean, like, and the pec's feeling more serious right now. I didn't feel anything wrong with my heart. I felt normal. I felt good.
So what a bonkers story.
Yeah, I mean, and I still actually, I see the surgeons again next week for my 12-week checkup. And I've got to go see my heart specialist and see what he thinks of me. I'm not sure when that is, but that should be soon too.
And out of pure curiosity, do you think like, and maybe your surgeon, your pec surgeon, your heart surgeon, maybe mentioned, like, do they think it had anything to do with, your PEDs? Because I know there's been some stuff around, like, especially tendon damage with, you know, bicep tendons, pec tendons, quad tendons, like, just because of the strength that you're able to gain so quickly that the tendons actually can't keep up.
Yeah, it absolutely could have affected my heart. My tendons are rock solid. They didn't snap, so it didn't affect my tendons. The bloody muscle snap. But there definitely could have been an impact from PEDs on the heart. They are stressful on the heart. There's a lot of interactions in play there. That being said, blood pressure was in range, heart rate was in range, everything was in range. All my monitoring was on track, so I didn't think anything was negative there. Mm. I wasn't doing anything crazy at the time. I probably would have pushed things further and further, that being said, so it could have been maybe a blessing. Definitely possible influence for sure.
Because, again, even though, you know, you may have been on PEDs in the past, you seem like a fairly active guy. I see you doing swimming a little bit and conditioning, so not just lifting weight. A lot of, like, even like Bass, for example, I'm going to say he doesn't do swimming or running very much. I listened to him once. He said, like, he can't even wipe his own ass. So, like, he's like, just just strength. Because a lot of them folks are just strength. You know, I listened to Mike Israetali talk when he's trying to build muscle. He's like, he doesn't even walk to the water cooler. He's like, I just don't want to burn any calories. I just can't be doing it.
Yeah, it's funny. Seb was actually talking about Thor. And it's just like, Thor's like, you're not moving at all. You're not moving a muscle apart from when you're on the platform doing a deadlift. It's like, up until then, we're feeding your food, we're wrapping your knees, we're putting your shoes on. You are not moving one muscle until you're doing that deadlift. Like, that's for months on end. And he'd just be like, absolutely nurtured. It's not doing anything but his lifts. And I thought it was crazy.
For those that don't know, Thor is the strongest man in the world. He's the but the Australian strength coach, Bass, is his coach. Or for powerlifting things. So did Bass program for you as well for your bench or just a technique?
No, I got some advice. We align pretty well with most of our programming stuff. So took a bit from his, took a bit from mine. We sort of worked together a little bit there.
So talk about that pre-training a little bit, just like the amount of volume you were actually doing, sort of your training, your recovery a little bit. And you sort of, we'll start there and then we'll go into sort of mindset a little bit.
Yeah, because it was the first sort of few months after deciding I was going to start pushing it, I still stuck with my very similar program. I didn't do a huge programming shift. A 4-day split, 2 days upper body, 2 days lower body. Both those upper body days were bench press focused with a one heavier day, one technique-based day. Almost like a conjugate mix to a degree. But instead of the speed work, I was doing more technique work on the second day. And that programming sort of I stick to my program for the most part, but I'm also that person who likes to push things. And I think that what ultimately led to probably a little bit of mismanagement fatigue in the end there. It was obviously, I sort of put the squats and deadlifts on a back burner towards the end a little bit, so that maintenance volume. 4 day split, upper body, lower body, and bench press focus really.
Yeah,
I didn't think I needed anything more to progress it. In that stage, it was more just practicing the technique and learning new skills in that manner. The muscle mass was there. I was going to just focus on ideally nailing that new form and new technique.
So you were doing 4 days training and then 3 days recover?
Correct. Although I would go for a swim. Yeah. I was very active. I did program in a GPP day. But that was very not much happening in that at all, really. It was just basic movements. It was 4 days training, 3 days recover, swimming once to twice a week.
Yeah.
I'm a pretty active guy. I do a lot of steps.
Yeah.
So walking is probably 12,000 a day. And just tracking what I can from there.
I always think it's interesting. We always like speaking to people that are obviously at the top of their game. Like we sent you that podcast about Lily. We speak to her and she would train 3 to 4 days a week, but then you have so many general population people that want to train 6 days per week, 7 days per week. It's like, no, you're not fucking getting anywhere. You just, and you look at these people, the best in the world or the strongest in the world, what are they doing or the fittest in the world? They aren't doing that.
I mean, you're spot on. I mean, especially as a coach myself, I even in very specific situations, I see very, very little need for a muscle building point of view to train more than five times at absolute most a week. Mm. I don't know if anyone five times a week is going to serve any real value to the person wanting to achieve pretty much any goal.
Yeah, for sure. And then obviously injury happened. Obviously your life's just been flipped upside down to some extent. Talk us about that post-injury mindset and then just starting back again. I see at one point, you said that you felt like a little bit of a beginner in some of the things that you were doing.
Yeah. So after the injury, my partner is very strict on me. She's like, you have to do exactly what the doctor says. Obviously, I was doing my research. I was researching everything I can about pec repairs and rehab processes and everything I can do. But pretty much the doctor said, don't move for 2 weeks because we just don't know. So I just, for the first 2 weeks, I just sat down, no walks, in my sling, and sat down for 2 weeks to watch TV. I still worked, but just with one hand, it was super slow.
Yeah.
In my sling. And yeah, that first 2 weeks was that sucked. Mm. And after 2 weeks, they gave me the permission to walk. So I started walking. Still with no training then. I was like, can I train? They're like, you still don't know. I was like, and I convinced them. Like they're like, oh, I can do a little bit of leg stuff as long as you're not, loading your spine or doing anything like that. I'm like, okay. So I've gone leg extension, leg curls, and anything I can do which is not loading anywhere near my pec or any way that I'll be tensing my chest. So I started leg training at about 3 weeks, and also my left arm. I started training my left arm. So I thought, well, I may as well keep training one side, and I guess there is a lot of evidence there. I guess you guys would have read the same evidence I have regarding to unilateral training and the crossover effects in terms of the immobilized limb.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, I'll keep training my good side, and I'll keep that side good, and hopefully that's going to translate to some preserved strength in my injured side.
She definitely does.
I think it did. Yeah, I definitely think it did. Once I started training, actually, I noticed that the atrophy was slowing down. Not that I can really see all that well, but I definitely did notice something. So the training from post-surgery from week 3 onwards was pretty much just 2 upper body days and 2 lower body days. But the upper body days were just one side. So it was a very similar program to what I was running prior, but just without my injured side.
And how much better, like I know from past experience, those first couple of weeks post-op where you can't do anything are mentally the worst. And I always tell either like the athletes I've worked with or the rugby boys, like, okay, just get through your first 2 weeks, and as soon as you're able to start doing some rehab stuff, you'll feel so much better. Did you find that yourself?
Yeah, as soon as we can progressively actively do something that can help recovery, we feel a lot better about ourselves. Even though during the rest we're doing something for recovery, we don't feel like we're making any progress to it. So I felt a ton, but as soon as I started moving and actually this moving body and even just moving the shoulder a little bit, I was like, oh yes, I'm making progress. I'm mentally feeling a lot better. But that being said, I think those first 2 weeks are extremely important in teaching patience and teaching mental stability. I think those are quite hard to get through. Mm. And if people really, really stay positive in that time, they can learn a lot. I learned a lot in those first 2 weeks, especially about, I'd say all around patience.
Yeah, we'll talk about that next. I want to touch on this a fair bit. Another thing that I find is really interesting, and if we just talk about like a maintenance amount of volume that you actually need to do to maintain, because we've had things like COVID come up this week or this year, and everyone just goes bonkers that they're going to just atrophy and they're just going to like melt away into like a piece of slime on the floor, and it's like, oh, doesn't really work like this. Like, so we've got muscle memory, which is a very real thing, but then you obviously have a maintenance amount of volume you need to do each week, which is really relatively low. Like it's not much work, and you can maintain all your muscle mass by doing very bare minimum.
It's funny you say that, because I reckon most people go, not most people, but I feel as though some people, especially those people who are training 6-7 days a week, if they go back and to maintenance or to do stuff in COVID, they might even find they're not making progress.
Yeah.
Because they were doing too much initially.
Yeah.
But I guess initially I thought, okay, well, it's immobilized. I'm not going to lose much, even though immobilized is different than not actually actively training it, because you're still moving it, you're still getting some stimulation there. But being completely immobilized in the sling, it's getting no stimulation. So I thought I've probably got 2 weeks before the muscle starts really, atrophying. And from there, I thought, well, this side, I'm not going to be maintaining the muscle. It's just not going to happen, because I can't actually put any volume through that side at all. But in terms of the rest of my body, you're like, I think we, as you just said, maintenance volume is much lower than what people think. I think Lane Norton just put a study out the other day, which I didn't like the study that much, but he said as little as one night of the volume can maintain gains in some people. But that was, if you read that study, it was beginners, not a very good population.
Always is, though, isn't it? Yeah, that's the problem.
Yeah, and but most of the research seems to say that one third the volume can maintain stuff, which is nothing. This doesn't come down to how big you are.
Yeah.
Also, another big thing in the equation I said before is PEDs. You've got almost maintenance PEDs as well as maintenance volume to a degree too. But yeah, the maintenance volume is much, much lower than what people think. So I wasn't concerned about losing size, and I knew we'll gain it back really quick anyway.
Yeah, and even things like, even if you can't train, but you are eating enough and you're still going, like, you know, eating your protein throughout the day, thinking about muscle protein synthesis, you know, those things in that nitrogen balance can keep mass holding on a little bit longer. So did you still concentrate on your nutrition, obviously, during them 2 weeks, or was it a little bit of a fucking free-for-all?
Oh, yeah. I definitely focused on getting my protein intake up. I found that my appetite was quite low, but yeah, mainly due to my decreased energy expenditure.
Yeah.
That being said, I was on several drugs for my heart. I was on like beta blockers and all sorts of other drugs, which just had me a bit slow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think they also impacted my appetite. So I was just focusing on, like, look, if I'm going to get one nutrient, I'm going to hit a protein goal. I'm just going to get protein in. So yeah. I was just eating meat and protein. I'm like, any calories I can get in, I'm just going to get protein in and just make the most of it. Yeah. So that was sort of the first 6 weeks or so until appetite started to return. Yeah. And then I was like, oh, let's push calories, just push calories, and let's get back up.
And then post-surgery too, I've had a few times, then you struggle to also take a shit for a couple of weeks. How long did it take to take a shit? It's quite chaos, isn't it?
I was good. I mean, I think I had must have had storage in me because I was all right.
You were coming out thick and fast. So obviously you've been hit with a sort of a massive adversity in your life for what your goal was, but with obviously adversity breeds resilience. And I think the more resilience we can actually have as human beings, the better. So now you've sort of, it's obviously still quite fresh, but now you're sort of coming out the other side. Do you believe that you may be better off for this eventually? And I mean, in terms of as a coach, in terms of coaching, empathy, compassion, sort of your ability to adapt, you know, it can, we can learn. Yeah. Like you said before, we can learn a lot through these stages.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all those things you listed off just then, like, resonate so hard with me now, because this being my first major injury, I haven't really been able to really understand or empathize with other people who have injuries. I haven't been able to appreciate, although I do appreciate being limited. I've trained people in the past who have injuries or limitations, and I'm very grateful. So that was okay. But everything else in terms of my adaptability and my patience, like I've been before, and my empathy is improved so much that I'm significantly better as a coach the past 12 weeks than I was before, like quite notably better. Without even really actively learning, it's just happened through experience and through this process. And I've actually spent more time, like, I mean, you might assume when you're really obsessed with a goal, you spend a lot of time on that goal. And now that goal has been to the side, I've had more time to spend on, you know, other things, which is, you know, I've found out, I've done more reading, I've looked at other aspects of my coaching, and I found that through this experience, it's made me so much of a better coach that I can quite confidently say that I'm a better person than I was 3 months ago.
Yeah.
Just from this experience. Whether I'll be a stronger person or not, that's a good question. But in the long term, this answer will be a lot more clear. But for now, like, I mean, even though I really want to be strong, I really want to have that strong chest and bench press record, what this has taught me has already almost caught up to what I've lost, and I find that quite fascinating.
I
think you see it so often, like, you can't have the good without the bad, and, you know, even in the worst kind of scenarios, you know, it might be hard to always see that little bit of good, but then when you find it, it's always like, you're always going to be super grateful you found it. And again, like, you know, we wouldn't even be having this conversation without, you know, you getting injured, as much as that sucks.
Yeah.
You know, we now get to add to our contact list, you know, have a good chat around it. And, like, people get injured all the time, unfortunately. It's a part of life, but I think it always helps when people share this story around how much it sucked. It sucks for everyone, but there's always good that can sort of come from it.
Yeah, and like you said, that injuries are inevitable. They're going to happen. Everyone's going to injure. If you don't get injured, I don't think you're trying hard enough in your goals. Like, you're going to get injured. Yeah. It's going to happen.
Somewhere, yeah.
But I think that being positive about the injury is something that's, I guess it's not openly really talked about. A lot of people just don't talk about the injuries or don't talk about what happens after them or where they come from. They sort of, they're injured and then they're better. Mm. Or they're injured and then they're never better again. It's never like, we don't get to hear the in between.
Yeah.
And I think the opportunity of growth there is just absolutely enormous. It's bigger than it could be. Any other situation you put in your life, to think of an injury and overcoming that is just huge.
Yeah, and you have to. There's always going to be so much emotion behind it, like you said. But people skip out that emotional side, that negative side, that dark side. They just want to skip over it and everything be fucking fairy dust and be like, "Keep a strong mindset, kids, and we'll get there." It's like, fucking shut up. But it's that adaptability. Like I said, you know, you're never going to get. We can say, I don't want to say never. You're never going to get the Australian bench record, right? But the goalpost just moves. The goalpost moves, like you said, you're reading more, you already feel like a better coach. Like the goalpost, something else. And I have no doubt, even just getting to speak to you for this hour, that you're still going to do astronomical things. I don't know what they're going to be yet, but you can just tell that's yourself as a human. It's really interesting to see what comes next. And you see it with, not like, even with like Paralympians, you see it, you know, like the worst things happen to them, but they just fucking stand up and they go and do something else. You know, you see people lose their legs, but next minute they're playing in a wheelchair basketball or that sick wheelchair rugby.
Yeah.
Tracking, do you know what I mean? And there's just other stuff. If you just stay a little bit mentally resilient and just build that resilience, you know, there's other stuff we can do.
So you're going to go for the Scott record?
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm definitely going to try to find out some sort of other athletic endeavor I can pursue, even though I've grown so much from in other areas of life. I definitely want to pursue something involved in that physical space.
Shot put.
Whether it's something on my legs or my endurance based or who knows what it's going to be. I think the ability to challenge myself after this and in that way is going to be huge for me. I feel as though I can't be stopped in my sort of pursuit in achieving something great in athletic scene.
What about single arm dumbbell bench press record? What's that?
Oh, look, I reckon that'd be cool. I can go left hand and this. Tried to break some record there. I mean, it'd be awesome.
But I saw, I went deep on an archive last night. I went back to a video you did in 2014 and you were like dumbbell flying 50 kg. And I was like, holy shit, man, that is, you know, that's about my dumbbell bench, you know, for one, your dumbbell flying things this long ago.
Yeah, I reckon that's probably that might have been my first year using PEDs maybe. Yeah. Or maybe, yeah, it's funny you say that because for some reason, dumbbell pressing hurt. I wasn't very experienced at the time. Mm. I didn't understand mode patterns very well, and I could fly. I'm like, well, I can't dumbbell press, but I can dumbbell fly, so I'm going to fly 50s. So I thought I'm going to get out there.
That's where you got big-ass chest. So. Last couple of things. Nutrition, like how many, I'm just out of interest, how many calories were you eating a day leading up to, like when you were practicing the bench? What were you on?
If I'm completely honest, I wasn't actually tracking at the time.
Yeah, okay.
Which is, at the moment, I only track calories when I have a need to track. And that need is normally a store when progression stops.
Yeah.
So if my progression is fine in terms of my weight and my performance, I won't track. I've diligently tracked for 10 years.
Yeah.
And I see huge value in tracking and having measurable data. And a lot of my clients will track as well. But at that time, it was just, I was like, eat as much as I possibly can. I sort of know where I'm at, but forcing food, eat as much as I can, measure my weight, measure my performance.
Recording stopped.
If weight stops moving, I'll stop eating. Sorry, if weight stops moving, I'll start eating more or start tracking, start being forced to measure it.
Yeah. I think that's the great, I always have a, between, I had bodybuilders and strongmen, you know, because bodybuilders tend to eat this whole food and it's lovely and then you still need to get 10,000 calories a day where strong men will just eat 10,000 calories a day or fucking whatever they want. They don't really care. It's just energy just to them. They just want to grow.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Yeah. I think that's it. Have you got anything else? I did have a couple more things, but I think that's
covered, yeah.
That's a everything. That's a beautiful way to end. And I want to just thank you for coming on. I didn't Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed that. I thoroughly enjoyed how open and honest you were. I do think, obviously, people will take a lot from this for sure.
Yeah, man, you carry yourself incredibly well. As much as that injury sucked, it's glad. It's great to see that you're able to find the positive out of it, and you know you're gonna inspire and help heaps of people. I'm glad there's more good people out there.
Yeah, thanks, heaps. Are both you guys MNU certified?
No,
just James.
Okay, yeah. No, awesome. I mean, I was actually looking into the course last year.
Yeah.
As I saw Martin probably 4 years ago, before he actually started the course.
Yeah.
And then I just popped up on your screen. I'm like, oh, I was like, I haven't thought about it in a while. I was like, wonder how he enjoyed it.
That's it. Yeah, no, it's good. Like from a nutrition, coming from like university level, it's a sharp course. Like it's really on point. The way they've done it is a phenomenal nutrition course. I would put it above any course that I've ever done, in all honesty.
Yeah, like, okay.
It's up there. Yeah. It's well worth doing. So where can people find you? I obviously know that you're a fully booked coach at the moment, but you have a wait list and stuff. But where can you find your Instagram? And then obviously if they do want to get your coaching service as well, if they do want to look Jackie Chan like yourself.
Yeah. Matt Hampton PT on Instagram and Matt Hampton PT on TikTok. I generally respond to everyone on Instagram, but feel free to email me also at matthamptoncoaching@gmail.com.
And we will stick all this in the show notes. But again, Matt, thank you very much for coming on, mate. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, heaps.
Legend. Thanks, man.